Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, I think episode number 326. Thank you for tuning in. I'm crazy excited about this one. In these strange lockdown times, I'm still trying to figure out what I want to do podcast-wise. And you will have heard me experimenting a bit with the album playback a few weeks back, the repeated isolation drunk cast, because essentially I want to try and avoid, like, there were guests I had lined up prior to lockdown that I don't want to just have on over Zoom. I'd rather be in the room with them and be face to face. So what I'm trying to do is, where I can, only doing Zoom ones with people I already know. So I already know there's going to be that connection and we can still get the level of podcast that I want to offer to you guys. So that's the explanation there. And that's why I've got a return guest this week, and it's Rutger Bregman. Now, I mentioned it in the podcast, so I won't go into crazy detail, but the podcast I did with Rutger, the first one, which was episode 190, if you didn't catch it, is probably the podcast, I was thinking about it when prepping for this one, it's probably the podcast that's had the biggest impact on my life, on my genuine personal real life. Because that podcast and his book, A Utopia for Realists, just opened my eyes to a few things and changed the way I think. It's funny because it also got me one of the bits of negative feedback I'm proudest of, because someone tweeted at me. No, not tweet. I think it's a review on iTunes, which I rarely delve into that. But they got angry because they said, I just agree with my guests and kiss their ass. I'll change my opinions completely to agree with their guests. And the example he gave was an outlook I had before the Rutger one, which directly conflicted something that Rutger said and I agreed with. And the truth there is, I did previously think completely differently. And then reading Rutger's book and seeing the history, the examples he gave, I touched upon it in the podcast. That's why I'm being a bit mysterious here. But yeah, essentially, in brief, I have always put, as a lot of you will know, a lot of weight on working the hardest and being self-motivated and working harder than everyone else. And there was something in Rutger's book and in the podcast that opened me up to that not necessarily being the as black and white as I maybe originally saw it. Anyway, it's why I was excited to have Rutger back on, because when I had him on the first time, I'd read half his book. I loved our conversation. I read the rest of the book, adored it. And I loved these ones that have a big impact on me. Wim Hof is another one. The episode with Wim Hof, which was, let me just scroll back and have a look when it was. I think it was 130-something. It was number 136. And yeah, that changed me massively, because just before I've recorded this, I've just had an ice-cold bath after a workout. And I have ice-cold showers almost every day. Definitely every day I work out. And I've been doing that for years now. And I go for ice-cold swims. And God, I adore it. It's my favourite thing to do. So it's one of them where it's that had a big impact, but that is also a podcast that I will admit that some of my... You also get educated by feedback on podcasts. So I had Wim on. I was in awe of him. I got some feedback from some people. I've read some more articles that people sent that questions some of his methods. And I think Wim is someone who I still think is absolutely amazing. But I do now think that there's some bits in his methods that are mind-blowing and really groundbreaking. And some bits that are a bit nonsense and a bit silly. But that doesn't mean it discredits all of it. Anyway, I'm rambling and rambling on. Rutger has got a new book out called A Humankind, and it's a hopeful history. It's called Humankind, A Hopeful History. And it's about the fact that he thinks humans are good, which is a weird opinion in the modern time. So let's just jump into that. I won't ramble on anymore. I'll be back at the end. If you've not heard the first one with Rutger, I'd recommend going and listen to it maybe before this one. There's not like spoilers or anything, so you can listen in any order. But yeah, give it a listen. And as you know, with these ones, that like Rutger's one ended up being one of the most less than two episodes of that year, but it's because it was so good and I raved about it so much. But the ones that don't have a huge name are the ones that people will scroll past, often scroll past on iTunes or wherever else. So if you enjoy this as much as I do, and as much as Buddy Peace, I've got a message off Buddy Peace, my producer, to say that he wants me and Rutger to just start a regular podcast, and he will produce it and do all the work, because he loves these two conversations that we've had. So, yeah, if you enjoy it as much as Buddy, then tweet about it and shout about it. You know that when that happens on these ones, I will end up screenshotting a load of them and resharing them myself. So, yeah. Oh, before we go on, actually, if you're listening to this on Wednesday, tomorrow, which is Thursday, and Friday, I'm doing hashtag Pod Bible listening party. So on Thursday at 7 p.m, we're all listening to episode one of North Star Rising, which is a science fiction podcast that I narrate. And me, Mike Biffle, who's the creator, a load of the cast will all be tweeting along, and we all listen at once. Basically, we all press play at 7 p.m, and you can fire any questions during or at the end, and hopefully all of us will tweet some interesting behind the scenes information. And yeah, it's a real cool experience. And then on the Friday, so the Friday is the 22nd, it's my dad's birthday, happy birthday, Dad, I'll be doing the same thing at 8:30, Pod Bible listening party, for my episode of Distraction Pieces with Joe Gilgan. So I know that's a favourite of a lot of you. So if you fancy revisiting it and asking me questions and going back and forth online with everyone else who's listening as well, it's not just about tweeting along and interacting with the people behind the podcast. It's about talking to other people listening to the guys at Pod Bible magazine. So yeah, that's all. They're doing them Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday next week. So go to Pod Bible's Instagram or Twitter page, and you'll see all the lineups and who's on. There's a Michael Smiley episode of Insane in the Membrane. There's the Football Ramble Lads. There's Drunk Women Solving Crime. There's loads. I've almost listed them all now, so I may as well remember them. White Wine Question Time, Giant. But yeah, loads to check out. Hopefully you'll enjoy this. Spread the word, grab the book. So this is episode 326 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Rutger Bregman. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
All right, ready?
Well, let's begin. Right, I'm joined today by returning guest, Rutger Bregman. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. I'm so glad to be back. Really enjoyed it last time. So
I really did. Your first visit is still one of my favourite episodes. And that conversation alongside your book, A Utopia for Realists, had real changing impacts on me and my life. Like, listeners will know that prior to that conversation, I was a big proponent of insatiable work ethic. Essentially, and I still stand by a lot of that, but I've now done a lot of work to kind of push and focus on the importance of leisure and the importance of time away from that. And I think that couldn't be a more appropriate kind of place to start, given the situation we're in. I think when lockdown started in so many places, again, I think I mentioned last time, my brother has a master's in philosophy, and he guides me on a lot of stuff. He'd been talking to me about a lot of the things that feature in Utopia for Realists around that time. And one of the things he said at the start of this was the problem that we're going to have a lot is people trying to replace work with work, rather than accept that this is a different situation and an unusual situation, because we're used to feeling worthless if we're not working. It's the weird society that we've built, where all our worth is valued on that rather than on other things, like fulfilling our artistic needs or our leisure needs or educating ourselves in different ways. So how have you found lockdown, I guess, and what have been your kind of observations at this stage?
Well, personally, not much has changed, you know. It's just that during a book tour now, you don't have to travel, which I must admit, I rather like that. And that it's just amazing to see that, and this happens during every crisis, I suppose, is that things that have always been the case are now becoming so incredibly clear, right, that you can't deny it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, for example, there are lists being drawn up in country after country with the so-called vital professions, right?
Yeah.
This happened everywhere, in the US, in the Netherlands, in the UK. And you look at those lists and you wonder, you know, where are the hedge fund managers? And where are the bankers? And where are, you know, they're not really there. Or the tax specialists or that help divert, you know, money flows for multinationals. Yeah. No, it's just sort of very straightforward. Nurses, garbage collectors, teachers, etc. Exactly those people who often get paid the least, you know, have insecure working conditions and now take the biggest risks in the fight against the virus, right?
And those that get looked down upon the most. Again, it was exactly that. As soon as I saw all of the praise and rightful love for those working in retail, in supermarkets and things like that, it made me think of the example in Utopia for Illis of the garbage men in New York who had no respect until they went on strike and then are seen as absolute heroes. And it's a similar thing here. Previously, people would look down their nose a bit at working in retail, at being a garbage man, at all these different things. Yeah. Whereas now, it's, as you say, rightfully praised as absolutely essential to our society.
Yeah. In the first weeks, I think, of the pandemic, we've seen a redistribution of respect, right?
Yeah.
Is that there's a huge amount of respect for these people, and we're all so grateful, and we really realize that we depend on them. I think that just redistributing respect is not enough. You know, now we need to take a step further and maybe also have a redistribution of power and of money. You know, it seems ridiculous that the people who do the most important work also often earn the least, right? Yeah. So this is the big question, obviously. What will this crisis mean for our future? And I think you can easily see us going down a very dark path. Right. Throughout history, crises have always been abused by those in power. You know, think about how 9/11 was sort of the start for two illegal wars, war on terror, massive government surveillance of citizens. Think about, you know, the rise of Hitler, you know, 1933. It started basically with a crisis. The burning of the Reichstag was abused by Hitler to grab emergency powers. Right. So we could see something like that again. And I mean, in Hungary, it already seems to be happening. But then it could also go in the other direction. I think there are also, you know, really exciting and hopeful times that this crisis might be different than the crisis of 2008. And that now ideas have entered the mainstream that used to be dismissed, you know, just a couple of years ago, whether you talk about universal basic income or a stronger innovative state, or, you know, cracking down on tax paradises, you know. It seems to me that the age of neoliberalism is ending and that the big question is what will replace it.
Yeah, completely. And, I mean, just touching upon the cracking down on tax avoidance, it's one of the things that, since our podcast, was delightful to see you blow up online at the Davos conference, which is a World Economic Forum, and you sat there in front of everyone and called them out, number one, on, you know, 1,500 private jets flying everyone in to talk about doing good and helping, and then, as said, the complete avoidance of talking about the rich not paying taxes or not paying their fair share and stuff like that. So The fact that stuff like that goes viral and gets attention gives me some hope, because it feels a lot of the time, and we'll get onto this with your new book, a lot of the time the news and particularly social media will really get in a storm over negative stuff. Mm-hmm. And rather than, look, here's some positive stuff, here's someone saying, here's what a solution could be, and things like that. So I guess, how was that when that all blew up online? Obviously, after that, you had the Fox News moment where you called out Carlson, Tucker Carlson, which, again, was a wonderful thing. For those who don't know, you kind of, you on air kind of said, look who you're funded by, look who you're paid by, look who supports you. And, it was a hell of a moment. Mm. How's all that been?
Very strange and very weird.
Yeah.
You know, I was invited to Davos to talk about my book, you know, the previous book, Utopia for Realists. And back then, basic income was becoming a more popular idea. You know, the idea of just giving everyone a monthly grant that's enough to pay for your basic needs and to completely eradicate poverty, especially in sort of Silicon Valley circles or entrepreneurs.
Yeah,
they thought it might be a good idea. So that's why I was invited. And at some point, the moderator asked me a question about poverty and about basic income. And I had decided to do something different because I had become really uncomfortable being at that conference. You know, you hear people talking about all these wonderful things, you know, whether it's feminism or climate change, but they never talk about taxes, right? And they never talk about inequality, or at least at their own role in, you know, making sure that the system stays as it is, right?
Yeah.
So it was the last day of the conference. I was happy that I could almost go home. And my wife had the day before said, you know, Rutger, you can't just go on that panel and promote your book, right? This is your one chance that you're there. Maybe you should tell them what you're really thinking. So she convinced me, and that's why I prepared their short speech. And I got the question from the moderator, and it basically ignored the question and gave this speech about as you mentioned, you know, 1,500 private jets coming in to hear Sir David Attenborough speak about how we're wrecking the planet, right?
Yeah.
And at that moment, there were very few people watching the live stream, so I didn't expect much of it. But I was just sort of happy that I, you know, sort of could ease my conscience and could go back and said, well, at least I told them what I thought. And nothing much happened over the weekend. But then on Monday, some website picked it up and it completely blew up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
so that
amazing.
That was really strange to experience. But also, I mean, I was also happy with it because I was basically saying what millions of people around the globe were already thinking, right? And yeah. I was glad that this was the biggest thing that came out of Davos this year. You know, they have this whole PR team, like they pay millions of dollars for their PR. And then this one viral clip of the stupid Dutch historian goes viral and gets more attention than anything else. Yeah, I thought that was pretty hilarious.
Or that's one of the things that I've enjoyed. And the Tucker Carlson bit is evidence of this. Is there's such a problem in modern journalism or modern, I guess, opinion sharing in often a lack of preparation and a lack of research. And I mean, I discussed this with a Russell Brand on the first ever episode of this podcast, because I kind of said I love a lot of his ideas, but the thing that kills me is he was going into these big opportunities without having done his appropriate research. So he's speaking kind of blindly, but you're a historian. So research is something you know very well. And that's what kind of shone on the Fox News thing with Tucker Carlson, was you'd done your research into the backers, the funding, the things he was personally involved in or paid by. And that's what kind of made it such an unavoidable confrontation, I guess, was
Thank you, any time
he came back with anything, you could say, well, here's who pays your bills. Here's who does this. Here's who sponsors this particular show and this kind of thing. It meant he couldn't just do what often happens in popular media and popular journalism now, of shout someone down and they can't come back because they've prepared maybe their first line and then...
Yeah. And the other big difference, obviously, was that, I mean, he didn't air it. And he didn't air it because he thought that I didn't have my own recording.
Amazing.
Of the interview, right?
Yeah.
So you got to imagine that this all happened in Amsterdam, and it was 2 a.m. in the night, right? Because there's a six-hour time difference with New York. And I went to the interview in a you know, a totally empty studio, and I was there with only the producer. And I told him, he's a young guy, and you know, we had a bit of fun beforehand, and I said, you know what, I'm going to tell Tucker Carlson the truth, but they'll probably never air it anyway, so... maybe you're the only one who'll be hearing it, but, you know, well, let's have a good time.
Yeah.
And so I asked him whether he could record the whole thing on his site so that I could at least show it to my friends and colleagues, you know, to you know, give evidence that I told Tucker Carlson the truth. And he said, no, I can't do it. You know, I don't have the means to do that on our site. So I went into the interview and... you know, was quite relaxed about it. I just thought, you know, I'll tell him the truth. And then he completely exploded. And I thought it was hilarious. I really thought it was hilarious that he just, he went nuts, right? He started shouting at me and I don't know. Well, people can look it up.
Yeah.
And then the interview was over and I thought, well, this is going to be a good anecdote for birthday parties, you know, in the next next couple of years. And then the producer came out of the, you know, his room and he said, I recorded the whole thing with my iPhone. And I said, oh, well, great. Could you share it with me? Yeah. So he airdropped it on my phone. Amazing. And I looked at it for a little bit and said, oh, this is funny. I'll post it on Twitter. So I immediately wanted to post it on Twitter, but it didn't work out because, you know, I didn't have proper internet. And I said, you know, let's just have a beer or something. So we drank a beer and then I got a cab back home. And, you know, it was 4 a.m. or something like that when I was home. Went to sleep, then woke up again. Looked at the video again, and only then I realized, holy shit, this is like a hand grenade that I've got on my phone here.
Yeah.
I mean, this is going to be pretty big, probably, when we publish it. So then 2 weeks later, after we had consulted 4 lawyers and made sure that sort of the Murdoch empire wouldn't destroy me, we felt confident enough to actually publish it. So yeah, that was it was a pretty hilarious thing to experience.
I love it that all of these things are kind of natural occurrences, if you know what I mean. The fact that he happened to be able to record it and then you happened to not have the internet to post it initially when it might not have been the wisest or safest.
Of course you prepare what you're going to say, right? You know what you're going to say when you go into the interview, but you can't really engineer sort of a viral moment. You can't really engineer that. I mean, I thought they would never air it, or that he would just stay nice to me, or just say, okay, well, then the interview is over. Bye-bye. Have a good time. And then, you know, then it would be nothing, right? But he exploded. I don't know. I must have touched a nerve.
I love it. So, I mean, it brings us on to your new book, Humankind, A Hopeful History. And I said this when you were on the first time. I went into Utopia for Realist kind of sceptical. Because, you know, I thought, is this going to be a bit hippie, a bit unrealistic, a bit pie in the sky? And man, I went into this book even more sceptical because of the times that we live in. Essentially, you're putting forward the idea that humans are by our very nature good, and really good and positive, and humans are indeed kind. But that's a tough sell when with the rise of Trump, with Brexit, with the right throughout Europe, racism spiking, all these different things that we hear all the time. So how did you kind of feel about approaching this and knowing that it was going to be, I guess, a hard sell and a hard argument potentially?
Yeah. Well, I knew that it was going to be a hard sell, and that's also why I knew it was going to have to be a big book, right?
Yeah.
Because the idea that most people deep down are actually selfish is so deeply entrenched in our culture.
Yeah.
And it is shared by people who are religious or atheists. It's shared by people who are left-wing or right-wing or poor or rich. You know, it is actually, I think, one of the most common and strong ideas in Western culture. It goes back all the way to the ancient Greeks, you know, the Greek historian Thucydides, who already, you know, gave us this view of human nature. Or you look at Orthodox Christianity, right? Saint Augustine talking about how we're all born as sinners, you know, the idea of original sin. Then you read the Enlightenment philosophers, and you assume that there must have been some break with Orthodox Christianity and the Enlightenment philosophers, right? But actually, their view of human nature is quite similar. You know, David Hume, Adam Smith, the father of modern capitalism, or Thomas Hobbes, the famous British philosopher, they all shared a quite cynical, pessimistic view of human nature. And then you look at the system that we've been living in for the past, well, say 40 years, right? The sort of neoliberal capitalism. And you realize that the central dogma of this system is most people are selfish, right? Sort of the greed is good idea, right? Just deal with it. People are selfish, and then design your whole society around it. So yeah, I realized it had to be a big book. But then the reason I started writing it is that something really, really exciting has been happening in science in, I'd say, the past 15 to 20 years. So scientists from really diverse disciplines, anthropologists, archaeologists, sociologists, psychologists, have all moved from a quite cynical view of human nature to a much more positive and more optimistic view of human nature.
Yeah.
And at one point, I was interviewing a psychologist. Her name is Marie Lindegaard, and she's done some terrific work on the so-called bystander effect. You know, I think some listeners will probably have heard of it. You know, the idea of that, when something happens in the streets, say someone's attacked or someone's drowning, And a lot of people see it happening that no one really helps because they're like, you know, it's not my responsibility. Someone else can interfere, right? This is called the bystander effect in psychology. And millions of students have heard about this, have learned about it. You know, it's still in every textbook. So Marie Lindegaard, this professor, was telling me about her new research where she didn't do laboratory experiments, but looked at how people behaved in real life, you know, because we have so many cameras in cities these days. She could look at the footage, right? And she had a database of 1,000 real incidents that happened in London, in Copenhagen, in Amsterdam, and in Cape Town. And she discovered that in reality, real people in real situation help each other 90% of the time. 90%.
Wow.
So this whole bystander effect, well, it's pretty much the opposite, actually. The more people see something happen, the more likely it is that someone will actually help you, right? So it was really the end of a whole research tradition, basically. And I was sort of discussing this with her, and I said, you know, I've also just been talking to a biologist, Frans de Waal, you know, who's written this wonderful book about empathy among animals, etc., and told her about new theories in evolutionary biology, that actually biologists have come to believe that we have evolved to be friendly, what they literally call survival of the friendliest. And she said to me at that point, oh my God, so it's happening there as well. And that's when I realized, this is a book, you know? I should sort of try and connect the dots. And
yeah.
Because all these brilliant experts, they're so specialized, right? They're really good at, you know, being the expert in their field, but often they don't notice what's going on in the field next to them, right? And that's why I wrote the book, just to connect the dots and show that something bigger is going on here.
I love that. And I love you start the book with a quote from Chekhov saying, man will become better when you show him what he is like. And it feels like a key theme going along in the book, because again, the book, it's not claiming that everything's wonderful and everything's fine. No. It's showing, you show a lot of times the reasons that things are negative and that people do act badly. And part of that is what we're shown and what we're led to believe. And it all becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if we believe, as we often do, that everyone is selfish and everyone is out for themselves, then we start to react in that way because we feel that is the way that everyone else will react. So
yeah,
it feels exciting and important that if there's that turn in science and in research, that we could start to make it a self-fulfilling prophecy in the opposite direction.
Yeah,
show
yeah.
people
yeah,
that we're good we need and turn a, around.
Yeah, and maybe we need a turn in music and the arts as well, right?
Yeah.
Because if you look at famous novels, so often they have a quite pessimistic view of human nature as well. In the book, I give the example of Lord of the Flies, right? The classic British novel about kids shipwrecking on an island. And initially they, you know, try to set up a democracy of sorts and work together. But that, you know, quickly breaks down. And at the end of the novel, three of the kids are dead. They're bullying each other. And, you know, it's this horrible story about what supposedly kids deep down are really like, right?
Yeah.
And William Golding, the author, received the Nobel Prize for it. So that's why, for the book, I sort of asked myself the question, well, this is fiction, but what would happen in reality, right?
Yep.
Do we know what actually happens when kids shipwreck on an island? So I started on this journey where I went looking for a real-life Lord of the Flies. And after a couple of months of research, I actually found one. So that was one of the most fun parts of the book to write.
It blew my mind reading this bit about Captain Peter Warner. And it was amazing that this isn't the most well-known story of recent times. But yeah, continue. I don't want to interrupt there.
Yeah. Well, it all started basically with me Googling on the internet, you know, just typing in a keyword like Lord of the Flies and real Lord of the Flies, children on an island. And after a while, I stumbled upon an obscure blog where this story was told, you know, just a short paragraph that supposedly in 1977, six kids had shipwrecked on an island, survived for more than a year, and were still friends. You know, and that it was a happy story of friendship and resilience, etc. And I thought, oh my God, if this is true, then why don't we know this? I mean, this must be huge. So I started looking for this, but every time I found the same words, the same short paragraph, right? And at some point I started to become suspicious. I thought, you know, maybe this didn't really happen. Maybe it's just a story that people tell to themselves on the internet, but you know,
Yeah.
It so often happens, but it's just, I don't know, fake news or something like that. But then I was just really lucky. I was looking for articles in newspapers from the 1970s, but by accident I had typed in the 1960s. So I was really looking in the 1960s. And then I discovered this article in the Australian newspaper, The Age, that said that 6 kids had been rescued from the island called Ata near Tonga, which is an island group in the Pacific Ocean, by an Australian captain named Peter Warner, and that they were still alive and that they were, you know, still friends, etc. And the paper said this will become one of the great classics of the sea, this story. Yeah. So I thought, oh my God, that this did actually happen. And then I realized, you know, this captain, he might still be alive, right? The guy who rescued these kids. I mean, he must be, I calculated, around 90 years old right now. And I also realized, well, maybe the kids are still alive. Maybe I could find them and track them down. So long story short, a couple of months later, I was in Australia with my wife for a book tour, you know, to talk about Utopia for Realists, the previous book. And I said to my publisher, can I have a couple of days off? Because I have a story that I, you know, want to find out about more. And so I rented a car in Brisbane and we drove 3 hours to the south. And there, you know, on the side of a lonely road in the middle of nowhere, there was this guy, Peter Warner, the captain. And he told us the story of what really happened on that island in 1965 and 1966. And he also put me in contact with Mano Toto, who's one of the original Lord of the Flies children and who also lives in Brisbane. And is still friends with Peter up until this day. They're still the best of friends. You know, they drink beers together, etc. They still go out sailing together. It's really... So they told me the real Lord of the Flies story. And, you know, if this would be a Hollywood movie, people would say, this is horrible. You know, this is worse than Love, actually. This is so unrealistic. This is so sentimental. You know, that is not how people would actually behave. But then, you know, sometimes reality is stronger than fiction, right? It's just... Yeah. It's really this story of resilience and friendship, that gives you a lot of hope. For the human species.
I love it. It's and it's fascinating because the theme that comes along in the book a lot is that the thing that's in our nature is kindness. Where we go away from that is the changes that we make and the supposed developments that we've had over the years. From looking at cavemen and all sorts of things like that, and seeing that when we were wandering kind of hunter-gatherers, there was a friendliness, a community. It was when we started to settle down into townships and civilizations and have hierarchies that started to change a lot. And people who are going into the book or even listening now, the first thing that might come to mind to argue against the innate good nature of man is Nazis, is Auschwitz, is these things. But the point that you make quite quickly in that section is that the telling part of this is that these things happened in highly advanced civilized societies. They didn't happen in the jungle, in tribes that hadn't been exposed. It didn't happen in the barest form of humanity. It happened in these supposedly advanced society. So how was that kind of having more and more realizations that the things that we feel put us ahead of how we once were may in fact be responsible for all the negativity or a lot of the negativity that's happened throughout history?
Yeah. Well, obviously one of the ironies of writing a book about human kindness and human cooperation or the good that is within human nature is that you have to go on for hundreds and hundreds of pages about the dark chapters in our history, right? You cannot get around the Auschwitz or the Holocaust question. You really have to confront it, right? And then you realize that actually human beings are not only one of the friendliest species on the earth, but also one of the cruelest. So to start with the friendliest first, right? If you want to know what sort of the true superpower is of us as a species, well, it's clear that we're not that smart or anything, right? Individually, we're not. If you have an intelligence test and you let a toddler, a human toddler, compete with a pig, then often the pig wins, you know? The pig is just better at arithmetic and logical reasoning and that kind of thing, which is something you should keep in mind, you know, the next time you eat bacon. But that's another book.
But again, just to touch upon that, it's amazing because the thing I love about your books is that all of this is proven. The studies are shown, and like a good eighth of the book is the notes at the back giving all the kind of here's where the research is from, here's the information. It's not just casually saying pigs are more intelligent than toddlers. Do you know what I mean?
Scientists have done a lot of work.
And studies that prove that,
So individually, we're not that smart. No, we're not that strong either. I mean, Neanderthals, you know, who still lived like 40, 50,000 years ago, were probably stronger than we are now. We're not even very good at climbing trees. So the big question is obviously why did we conquer the globe? You know, why didn't cows do it, or penguins, or orangutans, or chimpanzees, right? Why do we build pyramids and castles, and why do we go to the moon? You know, why is there not a chimpanzee on the moon? Yeah. And I think the most convincing explanation that scientists have come up with is that we're simply really good at cooperating. We're really friendly, right? So we find it relatively easy to trust one another and to work together on a scale that other species just can't. And this is, you know, what I earlier called this process of survival of the friendliest. So there's an extraordinary amount of genetic and also archaeological evidence that actually for thousands of years, it was the friendliest among us who got the most kids and so had the biggest chance of passing on their genes to the next generation. You know, imagine Donald Trump in prehistory. He wouldn't have survived for long. That's really, anthropologists are really sure about that. Because if you were selfish and narcissistic, the group wouldn't like you. They would expel you and you would die alone, right? Mm. Or if you were being really nasty, they would just kill you together, right? So it was humbleness and friendliness was really a prerequisite to survive, right? It was really important. As a leader also, you know, it was one of the central leadership skills to be humble, which is, I mean, very different right now. Now, often in politics, you have the survival of the shameless, right? The more shameless you are, the more narcissistic you are, often the better you do, which is something that, I don't know, to think about. But then what's important to realize is that there is also a dark side to this friendliness, right? The dark side of friendliness is groupish behavior or tribal behavior, that we find it hard to go against the group. And, you know, we talked about this last time when we were talking about, you know, how do utopian ideas become reality? Well, it often starts with people who are first dismissed as unrealistic, unreasonable, and are seen as unfriendly, right? I just read this wonderful book by Helen Lewis, who you, by the way, might have to have on the podcast sometimes. Yeah. It was a terrific book about feminism, you know, in the history of feminism in Great Britain, where she sort of tells these stories about how women actually got the right to vote. And the book is called Difficult Women because these women were not friendly. You know, they were not like friendly women, because progress often doesn't come from friendly people. And then the other dark truth about us is that so often things that we tend to see as good, like friendliness and loyalty and comradeship, are also implicated in our worst crimes, right? So if you ask yourself the question, why do soldiers keep on fighting? Why do terrorists blow themselves up, you know, then often, uncomfortably, you often find the answer that they do it out of loyalty for someone else, you know, because they're actually believing they're doing something good for their friends or for their families. So I don't want to give people the impression that I've written some kind of happy clappy book about the power of kindness. And if only we would be kinder, then all the problems would be solved.
Yeah.
But I am saying that we need to update our view of human nature to a more realistic one.
Yeah.
Because then we can design our society in a different way, right? We do not have to assume all the time that people are selfish anymore. And we can build very different kind of schools, different kind of prisons, different kind of democracies, or you name it, to actually try and bring out the best in other people.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, you're absolutely right. You also have to recognize that we're capable of the most horrible cruelties that you won't see elsewhere in the animal kingdom, right? I've never heard of a penguin that says, let's lock up another group of penguins, you know, that's and kill them all, right? Yeah, that is a really typically human thing to think of.
But that was one of the big breakthrough moments in the book for me, was when you were talking about the Nazi who was on trial and the trying to find where his evilness came from, because he was depressingly normal and depressingly, he wasn't the villain that we see on the TV screen.
Eichmann,
And again, it goes back to the TV representation of things. And the the revelation that came out of the research is something that I've always been obsessed with as an actor as well, is that the bad guys don't know that they're bad guys. They think mm-hmm. that they're doing good. As you said, they've got a loyalty to someone that has convinced them that what they're doing is good. So once again,
yeah.
in then even the baddest of the bad in their nature are trying ignorantly or incorrectly
yeah.
to do good, to do what they think is good. Yeah, so yeah. that was a powerful
thing.
This is
an uncomfortable finding, you know. It's not a happy finding. I mean, yeah. I mean, you have to wonder about yourself, you know. Am I actually doing good when I think I'm doing good, yeah. right? It really encouraged you to take a critical look at your own ideas and you know, everything that you're trying to accomplish in the world. I mean, it does mean that what they call sort of veneer theory, this idea yes. that civilization is only a thin veneer and that people are deep down, that they're all selfish, that is just wrong. That's really, really wrong.
Again, it's been hard to read because that's something I've always kind of believed. I felt we try really hard to be good people, mm-hmm. potentially against our nature. And that's why I was so interested by the subject of this book, because it's saying mm-hmm. the exact opposite of that. But yeah, chapter after after chapter, you prove that that's just categorically inaccurate.
Yeah, yeah. One of my favorite things, you know, about the research, or that you know, I had most fun with, was looking at reality television.
Yeah,
because yeah. what reality television makers have discovered, like 20 years ago when this all started, you know, with what was it, Big Brother, or you, yeah. before that you had MTV's The Real World.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they quickly discovered that if you put people on an island, or you know, in a villa somewhere far away from civilization, or you know, you put them in a space alone, just among themselves, nothing happens, you know? Just yeah. nothing really happens. They have a good time, they play cards, they drink tea. It's terrible. It's horrible for ratings, right? No one will watch a show like that. So they realize that they have to try and force something, right? Create something. So they start giving people alcohol, they start lying to them, deceiving them, setting them up against each other. And then maybe something small happens. And then they take that out of context and then they try to make a show, but sort of, it's really hard to make yeah. good reality television, you know, that people will actually watch, because it's not something that happens naturally. And this is something that I came across again and again and again. For example, if you look at the famous Stanford Prison Experiment,
yes,
that many people probably know, it's this experiment that happened in the 70s with Philip Zimbardo, still one of the most famous psychologist alive. He had this idea of putting, you know, just normal healthy students in a fake prison, right, in the basement of Stanford University. And so he had 24 of them, 12 were guards, 12 were prisoners, and he just said, you know, do what you want, you know, we'll just look on and study, you know, what happens. And the story that ended up in the textbooks and that people still tell each other today is that, you know, they very quickly develop this horrible sadistic behavior, right? Again, an example of this veneer theory, right? Deep yeah. down, people are evil, and you put them in this environment and they quickly show who they really are. And I mean, for 50 years, Zimbardo has told this story. It ended up in all the psychology textbooks, in so many documentaries, novels, films, you know, reality yeah. shows about it. Again, I mean, it's been so influential. And then we just recently discovered, thanks to the work of a French sociologist, Thibault Le Texier, who was the first one to actually go into the archives of the Stanford Prison Experiment and showed that it's a hoax. It's an utter, complete hoax. So Zimbardo instructed the students from day one to behave as sadistically as possible. And then these students said, no, we don't want to do that. You know, we just want to have fun, play cards, you know, make a bit music. And then he said, no, you don't understand. You have to do this because I need these results for my study, because then we can go to the press together and say, look, prisons are such horrible environments. We need to reform the whole American prison system. And you're lefty hippies, right? You want to help me with this. Yeah. And so that's how it happened. And just a couple of days after the experiment, he immediately went to the press and it became this huge thing. But this is like, I asked the French sociologist, you know, what we can still learn from the Stanford Prison Experiment. And he said, well, it's a good example of everything that can go wrong in science. But still, it ended up like this really famous scientific story. Now, where I'm going with this is that later, reality TV makers thought, you know, let's do this experiment again, you know, for the BBC, the BBC prison experiment. But then let's not interfere, you know, let's just see what happens. And this was a huge disaster for the BBC. You know, I watched all of the episodes, four in total, and it was so boring. You know, I'll never get those hours back. it's like nothing happens. In the first episode, one of the guards says, you know, maybe we can just talk about this as friends. And then in the last episode, they've set up this pacifistic commune and they're, you know, they're drinking tea together and playing cards in the cantina together. You know, it's that is what you really get when you have this fake prison. Nothing happens.
Yeah.
But that's not good for television. So, that's something that I discovered again.
Yeah, I mean, that part was fascinating to read because over 10 years ago, I had a TV show in development with the BBC that was based on a load of Stanley Milgram's experiments, but updating them, not only the shock experiments, but his lost letter experiment, his herd mentality kind of thing. Uh-huh. And the reason I walked away from it was because they wanted to add stuff that guaranteed a reaction and a result. And it was fascinating to hear about this show.
Really?
They go, oh, that's why. That's why. Because, again, I was like, well, we can adjust it to work now, and here's the modernisation. I can explain the original experiment, explain how it worked. And they were throwing in all sorts of stuff that was just literally, well, we'll get a reaction out of this, won't we? And kind of see...
That is so fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, or you see John Ronson's Psychopath Test book talks as well about some of the horrific things that producers of these reality TV shows do to push their guests to that level. So it was fascinating to hear that the reason for this is potentially the one time they did it as a true, pure experiment... It was the worst TV imaginable, and no one had
exactly.
any interest.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the problem with The Good in general. I mean, the big downside of The Good is that it's boring, right?
Yeah.
It's very hard to write a good novel or, you know, create a good movie about people that are, you know, just being pretty nice. There's this observation from Tolstoy in Anna Karenina, you know, one of his famous novels, where he says that every happy family is happy in exactly the same way, but then every unhappy family is unhappy in a different way, right? So every unhappy family is one novel, but then every happy family is just one boring novel that no one will ever read.
Yeah.
But then still, you know, we should remember that the stories we tell about ourselves are not just stories, right? They have real effects on how we behave in real life. So if we keep telling each other that human beings have evolved to be selfish, you know, and that you need to be really careful of other people, especially if you don't know them, then you'll start to design your whole society around it, right? And then maybe if you want to have a bit of social security, then people will really distrust you and you have to prove over and over again that you're really sick and depressed enough, then maybe the government will give you a bit of money. If you have an organization, then it will be a really competitive organization where people will be really distrustful of each other. If you have a school, it will be this like typically boarding school, you know, that will be, it's like the perfect environment for bullying. But if you turn it around, you know, you could have a very different kind of society. So that's sort of the point. Stories are never just stories, you know, they shape who we are and they influence our behavior.
Yeah. So, one of the things that interested me is obviously when approaching this subject, you must have drawn up kind of a hit list of the things that you had to look into.
Yeah.
Not even saying had to prove wrong, but had to look into. Yeah. And when you looked into them all, and Milgram included, Milgram, Zimbardo, Sherif, all of these experiments that are famous, the desire to be famous in many ways seem to outweigh the desire to be correct or to be accurate or to be right. As you said, I mean, you talk about a demand characteristics, for example, was a fascinating thing that anyone entering into experiment will more often than not be trying to help, will trying to be out. Yeah. The Stanford prison experiment was the easiest one that the guards were like, well, we want to help you get the results that you're after.
You want to be a good subject.
Yeah.
So the demand characteristics are really dangerous for good science.
Yeah.
You know, if sort of the participants can guess what the goal of the study is,
yeah,
they sort of get an idea of where the researcher is going, then that's what they're going to give the researcher, because people are generally nice and friendly. So that's what they're going to do.
Yeah. So, but the thing that struck me is there's a risk of focusing your theories on the public mm-hmm. rather than on academia and improvement. So how have you found it? Because you yourself are very much a public historian. So did you have to take stark lessons from the people that you were looking into to make sure that you were favouring the correct findings rather than the kind of a confirmation bias, I guess, rather than mm-hmm. the ones that back up mm-hmm. what you're trying to find. How was that in your journey on this?
Yeah. Well, you have to be really, really wary of your confirmation bias when writing a book like this. So I asked myself this question continuously, you know, do I actually believe this? Is this evidence really strong enough, or do I want to believe this?
Yeah.
Right. But there are a couple of things here. So in the first place, actually, when I started working on this book, or, you know, 5-6 years ago, I used to have a much more cynical view of human nature.
Yeah.
So why I wrote the book was that, you know, I had been thinking about ideas like basic income or a participatory democracy, you know, that's not just about career politicians, but also about us, you know, just average people also participating in daily politics. And I started to realize that actually all these ideas that I was excited about presupposed a different, more hopeful view of human nature. And then I realized that I actually didn't have it, you know, because I had studied history. I knew about all these famous experiments, you know, Milgram, Zimbardo, you name it. So that's when I started on this journey. Like, can you make the case for a more hopeful view of human nature? And then how would you do it? But for example, when in the beginning, I thought, you know, at least I have to make this concession that hunter-gatherers are very violent, right? Because I had read my Steven Pinker, who wrote this big book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. I thought, you know, that's one concession I have to make. Then you start doing the research and you go deeper and deeper in the academic work. And you realize, well, actually, it's the people who paint this very dark view of human nature that get all the attention in the press, right? That make the headlines.
Yeah.
But sort of the boring, dusty academics who are doing, you know, their hard work in the archives, they often have a very different view. And for example, when it comes to how violent hunter-gatherers are, well, most experts believe that war is a quite recent invention, you know, that really dates from the moment that we settled down and started doing agriculture, etc. But before that, when we were nomadic hunter-gatherers, we hardly did any wars. At least there's no archaeological evidence for it. And if we did, we should have found something. So that's one thing to keep in mind. At first, I was more cynical. I sort of wrote the book as a reckoning with my own ideas. And the other thing that I tried to do while writing the book, I asked myself the question, will this still hold up 10 years from now? Because so often what you see these days is that there's a new paper in, you know, these really influential magazines like Nature or Science. And then a year later, turns out, well, actually, that's not really the case, you know, or there's a new replication and it doesn't hold up. Especially in psychology, so many findings have been debunked in the past couple of years, you know. It's almost as if that whole discipline had to start over, you know, with a blank slate and just, okay, let's start again at the beginning, right? So that's something I kept in mind. And then what you start doing actually is you start relying on research traditions. So not so much on that fancy scientist with that, you know, revolutionary new insight, but more on like, okay, so do we have a whole body of evidence on this? And sometimes you also come at more common sense conclusions. So one simple question I ask in the book is, what is the best way to bring people together, right, if they hate each other? What is the best way to counter racism and hate and prejudices? And the common sense answer would be, well, maybe it would be nice if people would actually meet up sometime, you know, and actually do something together, you know, contact as a remedy. Then you could say, well, would you really need to, you know, scientifically do research on this? But, you know, everything is obvious once you know the answer. So, yes, you do need to. Yeah. And turns out we have 50 years of evidence from sociology and psychology, you know, again and again when researchers have looked at this. Turns out, yes, contact works. You know, this is what they call contact theory. And it's one of the most important insights, actually. And you should really keep in mind when you're trying to build a school system or a democracy is, are people actually meeting each other, right? Mm. So do we live in these bubbles where you only meet people who are like you? Or if you sent your kid to school, will that be a diverse school? Because then, you know, from your earliest years, you'll have the experience of diversity, right? And you'll be used to that. I mean, it's a very simple insight, but yeah, someone still has to prove it. And so that's what you start doing. You start relying more on those research tradition instead of sort of the latest counterintuitive insight. So I guess we'll have to do a podcast 10 years from now and see if I did, you know, well enough on this. But yeah, I did my best.
I love that. And I love the simplicity of pointing out that actually meeting people of the same view, of different views, is key. It's one of the things that came up in the section about Nazis was when a lot of them actually met people who opposed, their view was changed because they'd not met people who opposed. And it made me think, a friend of mine recently was messaging me on WhatsApp and he was really annoyed because he'd mentioned it in a group and I'd stepped aside of the group to talk personally because he was annoyed that he felt that he was constantly being called a racist, which is worrying from a friend because I'm not a big fan of racists, but I kind of spoke to him. I was like, so who's called you a racist? He's like, well, I've read that if you believe this, then you're a racist. And this is like, no, but who's called you a racist? And it got down to, it's just his belief of these people out there. And it's the same on either side. This belief that there's these people constantly attacking you, when in reality, they're not. No one's actually been attacking you. You've just read that you're attacked and you feel attacked. So that simplicity of actually meeting people and having conversations and having those interactions is something that we're really lacking in the social media world. And I think it's why it's such a poisonous world. It's strange that I'm very much on social media a lot. I use social media a lot, but I'm convinced it's having far more of a negative impact than a positive impact on society because of what you're saying here. It perpetuates this constant conflict that potentially isn't there.
Here is the role that distance plays. So distance is, well, you could call it the sort of the source or the root of all evil, right?
Yeah.
It's very hard to really hate someone who's standing in front of you, right?
Yeah.
That you can see in the eyes. Human beings have sort of been designed by evolution to trust one another when we can actually meet each other. I mean, you can see this when you look at our bodies, you know? We are the only species in the whole animal kingdom that blush, which is a fascinating fact about human beings. I mean, why do we blush? Chimpanzees don't blush, orangutans don't blush, bonobos don't blush, but we do. So why do we do that? I think a convincing explanation is that it is a way for us to establish trust, right? You involuntarily give away your feelings to someone else, what you're thinking deep down. And it just becomes easier to trust someone who's capable of blushing. That's why it's really difficult of imagining to trust someone like Trump, because, you know, you can never imagine him blushing, right? And we also know from research that actually those who are in power often find it hard to blush, right? Because power corrupts, you know, it's really a dangerous drug. But also if you look at our eyes, for example, there's a really striking finding here from biology is that human eyes are really unique. If you look at all the other primates, and there are more than 200 species of primates, they have sort of black around their eyes, what they call the sclera, right? And they're sort of brown or black. So that makes it really hard to follow their gaze to see what they're actually looking at. But then we have white around our eyes. We have white sclera, which means it's really easy to see what you're looking at, right? Or what other people are looking at. And obviously this plays a hugely important role in establishing trust, right? If you're like a chimpanzee, then it's a bit like a member of the mafia, you know, with sunglasses on, right? Like hiding the gaze. But we can't. We just give it away. We can't help ourselves, right? And this really, so we've been sort of designed by evolution to trust each other in this way. But that only works, of course, if you're actually close to each other. You know, on social media, you have a very different situation, you know, where you're all behind your own laptop. And this is really a thing that I stumbled upon again and again while, you know, working on this book. For example, if you look at the history of warfare, it's actually really difficult to be violent or to kill someone who's close to you, right? Or who's like standing in front of you.
Yeah.
If you look at, for example, bayonets, most soldiers can't do it and have never been able to do it. To just shove a bayonet down someone, right? We know from, you know, for example, after the Battle of the Somme or Battle of Waterloo, that, you know, very small percentage of the wounds was caused by bayonets. Almost all these soldiers were killed by artillery, right? Because it's psychologically much easier to just push a button and then have an explosion somewhere far away and kill some people that are just abstractions to you, right?
Yeah.
But to look someone in the eye and then to actually kill is almost impossible. One of the most fascinating findings here has come from an American historian and military man who was with the U.S. Army and was the first one to discover that actually most Allied soldiers, and probably also German soldiers, but we know for sure about Allied soldiers, didn't shoot during the Second World War.
Yeah.
They just couldn't do it. On average, only 15 to 25% in his estimate could actually fire their guns. Most didn't do it. Why? Well, there's just this psychological thing within us that sort of holds us back, right? You really have to learn to be violent. And that is possible, right? So you can condition soldiers, you can brainwash them. There are ways to sort of dehumanize the enemy as well psychologically. And this all makes it easier. And I mean, this is a really dark truth about us as a species that we're capable of actually doing that.
Yeah.
But it's not something that comes natural to us, right? So we like sex. That is, you know, everyone understands what's, or at least most of us understand what's nice about sex, and you don't have to teach someone well, or you don't have to teach a teenager to enjoy sex, right? That's something that it's intuitively enjoyed. Same as food, right? You don't have to sort of, your body knows that it's good for you because you're hungry and then you want food. But with violence, it's very different. You really have to learn how to be violent. It's a long road, and often you damage yourself in the process. So again, we know that soldiers who come back from wars and have actually killed someone else, they often develop PTSD, you know, because not only have they killed someone else, but they've also killed something inside themselves, which suggests to me that, you know, we're not born to be violent.
But again, it comes back as well, I feel, to what you were talking about, how we represent things in the arts, because you talk about how Hollywood violence has as much to do with real violence as pornography has to do with real sex. But in both cases, the myth influences the reality, right? Sexual practices have changed and developed and been influenced by what we see in pornography. Therefore, potentially, violence and our ability to exact violence is going to change the more it's portrayed on screen. I said it was fascinating to read those stats about war, because I realised my only real experience of war is in films where they're happily shooting excitedly away, and then you read how those small percentages and the amount of guns that were found loaded and unused and things like that on battlefields is fascinating. It's interesting how those
series like Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
I mean, Game of Thrones is always being described as sort of this realistic series. I mean, I always have to laugh a little bit. Well, obviously there are dragons in there, which maybe are not very realistic, but sort of it's realistically seen as realistic because, for example, the violence, right? But it's so, I mean, in Game of Thrones, people are continuously shoving swords down each other, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, people are capable of that. Don't get me wrong. But it's really, really hard. It's really hard. You really have to, go down a very long and dark road before you're able to do that.
Yeah.
It's not something that comes naturally.
As we're at the hour mark, I'll wrap things up here. And one of the things that jumped out to me as potentially relevant now, more relevant now than when you wrote it, if that makes sense, was when you talk about the dark ages that different civilizations have been through, where their civilization or society has crumbled and it's been seen as these huge dark patches in history. And you kind of put forward that actually they may have been a reprieve, a chance for us to come back and maybe remove some of the negative things that society had put upon us. And I was just wondering your thoughts on the world post-lockdown, I guess. Because, I mean, ecologically, it's been undeniable that it's been a reprieve on the world, on the lack of flying, the lack of pollution, the change in that has been a massive reprieve. How do you think this could affect us as people? Because we have also seen, again, rather than riots in the streets, we have seen outpourings of support of people going and buying shopping for neighbours that they've never met, of people donating, applauding, all these different things. There's questions on the impact of them, but all these different things we have seen society seem to care more about everyone in this period.
Yeah.
But we have also had the distance that you've talked about being an issue. We haven't been able to see the whites of each other's eyes for some time. So, as an ending, what do you feel the potential positives could come out of this situation that we're currently in?
You know, recently a journalist asked me, what will the next 80 years look like? You know, I couldn't help but laughing because I thought I find it hard to predict the next 8 hours in my own life, right? So, let alone the next 80 years. I mean, as a historian, you know that we have absolutely no clue, right? The future is always fundamentally open. And that's also what should give us hope, because hope is about possibilities, right? We're not on this roller coaster. We actually have power to change our own lives and change our own futures. And so what I hope is that this crisis will give us an opportunity to move to a different view of human nature, to redesign our societies, maybe from the bottom up, with different values. So if you look at the last 40 years, we have been governed by, you know, the values of competition and selfishness. And often this has been advocated as a force for good, right? So the greatest good idea.
Yeah.
And we've seen the results, right? An epidemic of loneliness, of anxiety and of depression, of increasing inequality, tax evasion, you name it, right? And in the past couple of years, it's been becoming clearer and clearer to more and more people that, you know, we need something different. Now, when the crash came in 2008, you know, sort of people knew what they were against, right? They knew they were against austerity or the establishment, and they were angry. But they really didn't have an alternative. What my hope is that this crisis is different because actually we've done our homework, right? Mm. There have been so many ambitious and brave people, whether you talk about, you know, brilliant economists like Thomas Piketty or Mariana Mazzucato, one of my favorite economists, or you think about protesters like Greta Thunberg, you know, who spearheaded, you know, the biggest climate justice movement the world has ever seen, or think about this formerly unknown Asian American businessman, Andrew Yang, you know, who's become a very unlikely presidential candidate and really made waves in the US with the idea of universal basic income. So I think now we're much better prepared sort of to handle this crisis, or at least to inject new ideas in the debate and make sure they're taken seriously. And then maybe historians will later say that this was a turning point, right? That the age of neoliberalism, the age of selfishness and competition, etc., ended. And that we move to something, I don't know, maybe you should call it something like neo-realism, right? Where we had an updated view of what it means to be realistic, right? Of what it means to be real.
Yeah.
And that is actually a much more hopeful view. That's what I hope.
Yeah, I completely agree. Well, thank you very much for your time. Utopia for Realists is available now, and Humankind is available to pre-order. I want to encourage anyone who is listening you've got time at the moment, so open up your Google Maps or Apple Maps or whatever else and just search bookstore and look at what your local bookstore is. And if you click on it, it'll normally say if they've got a website, and if they have, order from them, because they're important to support and keep alive in these times. And I know in the normal endlessly busy world, it's so much easier to just one click order from Amazon, but you've got time now to order from local bookstores and support bookstores all over the country and in your local area. But thank you very much. It's been a pleasure as ever. It feels like we're going to have to do this every couple of years and just check in and see what else has happened to inform us. So thank you for your time, and stay safe and well.
Thanks. Looking forward to the next time.
Thank you very much. See you soon.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was my second round with Rutger Bregman. And as you will have heard at the end there, we both enjoy having these chats so much that we've suggested we do it again at some point. We will have put links in the description on iTunes and all that to Rutger's moment at the conference. where he rallied, he talked about the fact that all these people had come in on private jets, and we'll also put his argument on CNN. They're linked in the description. Thank you for tuning in. I'll be back next week. I don't know what I've not recorded it yet. I've got a good few potential returning guests lined up. I've got one or two potential guests who I wouldn't have been able to get on otherwise, I don't think. So I'm going to try and do them over Zoom. I'm thinking of doing a behind the music of my No Commercial Breaks album because the Distraction Pieces one went down so well. We've got a few more drunk cast ideas, but really after that last one, we all need a bit of recovery. So let's chill out on that. I want to do one with the We Are Lizards guys, the guys I ran my club night with for years. So, yeah, a lot of things in the pipeline, but I don't know what any of them are yet. So I will see you next week for the Distraction Pieces podcast. And remember to shout about this episode far and wide. I think genuinely, regardless of whether it's my podcast or not, I think this is a podcast that a lot of people could do with hearing right now because we are quite negative and quite angry, as was I. And as am I sometimes. Obviously, I'm not completely cured, but a thing like this really, it wakes you up. And weirdly, just after I recorded this podcast, I went on Twitter and Ian Lee, previous guest and just friend, a person I adore, he was getting quite down at the way a lot of humans were reacting to lockdown. It was that weekend where a lot of people were going out and all things like that. And I was inspired to tweet him, and it really helped. He ended up deleting his initial tweet and giving a little thank you because I just kind of pointed out that, I mean, yeah, there's some people who are breaking the lockdown rules and the social distancing rules, but also there's millions upon millions of the vast, vast majority who are completely obeying all the rules for an unprecedented amount of time. To have this kind of lockdown and to have it so widely obeyed and adhered to, as said, by millions upon millions, the vast, vast, vast majority is amazing. So we could look at how awesome that is and how amazing humans are, rather than get really angry because we've got social media now in the news and we hear about the worst blotches on society and on the world, and we hear about them all the time, so it feels like they're constant and they're the majority. Anyway, I really enjoyed this podcast, as you can tell. I'll be back next week. Ta-ta, stay safe, stay home. If you want to stay alert as well, you do you, but let's stick with the more descriptive and specific instructions, eh? I turned it negative at the end. What a dickhead. Stay safe, stay lovely, and stay wonderful, you beautiful people. See you next week. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.